Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABBAclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Lisa T., her home group is the Henry County group of Stockbridge. And I've known her when she would sit over here. And she got sober 2006, December 2006, which was before me. She cleared her head out and went over to UGA. She's going to tell you all about it. But this woman is living the promises. She's a great speaker to have for New Year's Eve. Give her a big welcome, Lisa T.
Hey, my name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 22nd of 2006, and I'm going to thank Tim for asking me to speak tonight. I used to come to meetings here. Like he mentioned, I went to UGA a couple of years ago. But I used to come to a Saturday morning meeting here for about 2 years. I was here every Saturday, and I did sit over there and against that wall. So it's good to be back at NABBA. I see some familiar faces, but sorry, I'm a little nervous. I grew up here in Atlanta. In Gwinnett County, and I come from an alcoholic family, so there's a couple other alcoholics that have been in and out of recovery for as long as I can remember in my family, so it goes way back. But I was a typical kind of alcoholic way before I found alcohol. There's a lot of chaos and financial insecurity in our home growing up, and you know, just a lot of drama. Every time you turned around, there was something happening. And so I was this little kid where I didn't fit in anywhere, and you know, I had this attitude and this chip on my shoulder everywhere I went. And I just wherever I went, I just didn't fit. And I'm sure, you know, everybody can I've heard other alcoholics in meetings say that. But so growing up, I just remember being self-sufficient, almost to a fault. I was telling somebody on the way over here how, you know, there wasn't a lot to go around in our family, so I started working when I was in high school. And I made good grades, and I partied, and I worked. So if I was out of school, I worked for 40 hours, you know, on breaks and summers. And I bought my own car, and I just kind of remember always being the self-sufficient Lisa and thinking, well, if I want something, I'm going to have to make it happen. And I just didn't really feel like I had anything or anyone to depend on but me. And I grew up in the church. Our family is diehard religious. We were there every time the doors of the church were open. Monday night, Wednesday night, Sunday all day, you know, Sunday night. My mom was in the choir. My dad played in the orchestra. So we had this kind of, like, life that we showed the outside world, but you know, behind closed doors it was a different story. And so that was kind of the theme in my life, was like this double life. So in high school I made good grades, but once I found alcohol when I was 14, it was, you know, just I hung out with the kind of rough crowd, and school wasn't all that important to me. And not many people took me seriously. It was just kind of like, oh, it's Lisa, she's a drunk. It was, I was drinking Golden Grain when I was 14, and I see 14-year-olds now, and I'm like, gosh, I thought I was so grown up back then. But I was a child, and I drank to get drunk from the beginning. I never was one of those people that, you know, had a little bit here and there. I started off like blackout drinker, getting carried out of parties, you know, high school parties. And I never understood, you know, why other people seemed to be able to just have little, but I would just be like falling over, sloppy drunk, and people thought it was, you know, funny at the time. But you know, I think of it now, and I'm like, that was not funny at all. I'm lucky to be alive. So after high school, everybody in my high school went to college, and I went because I didn't want to be the only one at home, you know, with my parents or something. So I just kind of followed some people that I knew from high school. And, of course, I wound up at a party school. And I had this intense fear of people. I didn't realize it till later. But I was just terrified of people. I couldn't sit and just have a conversation with somebody because I was always thinking, what is this person thinking of me? Am I saying the right thing? What I'm saying is stupid, you know, that kind of thing. And so the only time I felt comfortable was when alcohol was around. I joined a sorority hoping that, you know, I might be able to adjust to college life easier. But, of course, it was the party girl sorority, and I couldn't understand why the girls that had good grades didn't want me to join theirs. Because that's, you know, my idea of who I was totally different than what other people thought. So I wound up, you know, I remember thinking, well, so-and-so in the sorority has a 0.0 GPA, and her parents made her come home. So I'm drinking, and I'm making good grades still, so, you know, I'm doing great, you know. And I thought the way that I drank, I thought everybody drank like that. So Monday through Thursday, I would white-knuckle it. I wouldn't touch a drop. I had all these activities like volunteering and working out, and, you know, I was a vice president in the sorority, you know, all this stuff. And looking back, it was really just to distract me until I could drink on Thursday night and the weekend, because Thursday night's when everybody went out. Of course, I only went to the functions with the sorority that involved alcohol. I didn't do any of the ones that were like philanthropy or family day or anything like that. It was like, if there was booze there, I was there. Otherwise, no. And then, so you can kind of see the progression. And when I was in college, you know, it started out fun. I was on the 5-year plan. The first couple of years it was fun, and, you know, I fell down the stairs when I was drunk, and had to have surgery on my knee. And it was still fun at that point, but as time went on, I remember it started to get, I was more and more isolated. I stopped going to the parties. I kind of quit hanging out with the sorority, and I'd burned a lot of bridges in the sorority at that point. So I just remember spending a lot of time alone my last year there and just being really depressed. And I couldn't even take a full load of classes. It was like real, you know, one or two classes at a time. And I was just kind of drinking on my own more. So when I graduated from college and moved to Atlanta, I got a job, and I moved in with some sorority sisters over on Lenox Road, and we had a condo there, and it was back when the bars in Buckhead were still around. And so it was the same thing, except it got worse, where Monday through Friday I worked. I didn't touch any alcohol, but on the weekends I would just like let loose. I mean, Friday, I remember being so excited for Fridays to come, and I'd be getting ready to go out. I would stay out till 6 in the morning, and I would be so sick the next day that I couldn't get out of the bed, and I couldn't eat or drink anything. I would just have Gatorade, and I would be throwing up, just dry heaving. I just remember being over the toilet and saying, I'm never drinking again, every weekend. Then I'd get up and go out on Saturday night and do the same thing again. And I remember my roommate at the time saying, "Lisa, I'm really worried about you." And that was she was a heavy drinker. At the time I was seeing therapists and doctors and parents, and people are always saying, "Lisa, you're still doing the same thing you did in college. Like, when are you going to grow up? You're 23 now, and when are you going to get your life together?" And I didn't understand what they meant, because I still thought that everybody drank. I mean, my life, my whole identity was being the party girl Lisa, and I remember thinking that it was like an honor if somebody asked me, "What's the best place to go out on a Friday night?" I just remember being like, "Oh, like flattered that they asked me where to go out in the city or something." And I mean, really, I didn't have any interests. I didn't have any. Just everything in my life revolved around alcohol. But what's sad is I didn't realize it. I didn't know that there was life beyond alcohol, and I was still really relying on me and what I know. And there's somebody in McDonough, an old timer, that says, you know, if I didn't know about it, then it wasn't worth knowing. And that's kind of how I think that sums it up for me. That's how I was, you know, if I didn't know about it, then it wasn't worth knowing. I mean, you couldn't tell me anything. So about this time, you know, I was having problems with work. I was having problems with my roommates. And I remember thinking, well, if I just became a dentist, that would fix everything. I mean, if I just go to dental school and then, you know, my life would just perfectly unfold. So I spent thousands of dollars, thousands, on applications, flying to interviews. You know, I took the tests, and I had the recommendations, and I had experience working in a dental office and all this stuff. And so I had the qualifications on paper, but I would go to the interview and blow it. And I know the only reason I know that is because I had the nerve to make an appointment with the dean of admissions of one school that I didn't get into. And, you know, I said, "I have this, this, and this. And, you know, I know that you accept people with less than that. So why didn't I get in?" And she said, "Well, Lisa, you have to come across as teachable." And at the time, I was like thinking, I mean, I want to learn about teeth. Like, what is she talking about? I had no idea until years later. I was sitting in an AA meeting, and I think people were, you know, the topic was something about being teachable. And all of a sudden it clicked with me, like, oh my God, that's what she meant. But looking back, I mean, I wouldn't have wanted me sitting in my classroom, because I knew everything. You couldn't tell me anything. I thought I had everything figured out. So when I didn't get what I wanted, you know, I had this plan scripted out for my life, and when I didn't get what I wanted, what I thought that I needed to be happy, my drinking spiraled out of control. After all that effort and all that build up, you know, and then it didn't turn out the way I wanted. So my drinking just, I mean, it was like a string of bad things kept happening. I didn't get in trouble with the law, but I did get pulled over by the state patrol after I'd been drinking. And by the grace of God, he let me go. Then I got rear-ended on 85 and had to go to the hospital. But, I mean, there wasn't alcohol involved in that. But I remember feeling like, every time I turned around, there was another fire to put out. I was like, I got robbed. I was about to lose my job. I had a roommate, falling out with the roommates that I lived with. So I moved in by myself. And I stopped going out. I mean, I just sat at home and drank. My phone eventually stopped ringing. I didn't get invites to go out. There would be entire weekends where I didn't talk to a soul. I just sat at home and drank. And I remember talking to my mom on the phone one weekend, and I just could not stop crying, and I couldn't explain why. And I just, I mean, it was pitiful thinking back. I just could not stop crying. And, you know, I lost all this weight. My hair was falling out. I mean, it was just, I can't even remember. I know there's other stuff that was, I was just so miserable. I was walking out in crosswalks because I used to live over by Chastain Park. And I remember just having so much rage that life wasn't going the way I thought it was supposed to go. And just walking in front of cars, there's like a crosswalk from, you know, a neighborhood to the park. And I remember walking in crosswalks and thinking, I really don't care if this car hits me. Like almost inviting it in. I would invite in bad stuff to happen because I just felt like so low, you know. And I drank because I couldn't live with myself. I drank because when I looked in the mirror, I could not stand the person that I was, you know. I mean, I just, and when I hear the feeling of uselessness and self-pity, I mean, that sums me up. Like, I just felt so useless. Why am I here? Full of self-pity. I mean, I don't think I was thankful ever for anything until I came. I was always looking at, you know, this didn't go my way, this person isn't doing what I want, kind of thing. So about that time, my younger brother, who was 5 years younger than me, was seeing a therapist that said, you know, if you don't go to AA, I can't help you anymore. Like, this is a waste of time. So he started going. He had been sober for about 6 months, and he had a sponsor that said, you don't have a relationship with your older sister, and you need to start calling her every day. So he did. And I remember when he, you know, because we didn't know each other except from maybe partying together here and there, but, you know, growing up, we were at each other's throats, and we just didn't really have a relationship. But when he started calling, I remember thinking, what does he want? He wants something. Why is he being so nice? But he would listen to me go on and on and on. And I remember he told me that he was, I think he told me he was going to AA, but I had no idea, you know, what AA was about. And I remember being on the phone complaining about how horrible everything in my life was, how I just wanted to die. And he was like, well, did you ever think your drinking might have something to do with that? And I will never forget that. It was on the phone, and that was the first time somebody said something about my drinking, and I, it kind of got through to me for just a second. It was just kind of like, huh, never thought of that. But then, you know, I kept doing what I was doing. And I remember him telling me, yeah, I have, you know, 3 months or something. And I said, oh, well, you should come down and we'll go out and celebrate. You should come to Buckhead and we'll go out and celebrate. I mean, that's what I thought. AA people just came and talked about how bad their life was. I was shocked, you know, when I came. Eventually, I'll get to that in a minute, and found out that people weren't drinking. I was like, wait a minute. So I just remember there was something different about him when we talked. He wasn't full of hate. He wasn't, you know, his life was getting better, and here I am, like this shrinking violet. Things just kept getting worse. And he would say, well, hey, you want to come to a meeting with me? And I'd be like, oh, no, I got to do this, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, eventually things got so bad that I was like, okay, I'll come. And I mean, I guess he dropped everything that one time I agreed to go and came from Lawrenceville and drove all the way down to Atlanta and picked me up and took me to his home group in Lawrenceville. And his sponsor was chairing the meeting that night, and he called on me to share. And I just, like, cried the whole time. And I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. I don't think I'm supposed to be here. You know, I was like, I'm the youngest person here. I don't belong. And the women passed out, you know, little phone number sheet, and they all wrote little notes to me. And it turns out one of the women that wrote her name and phone number actually am friends with her niece in Athens that's in the program, and she said, oh, my aunt Amy, blah, 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 she goes to the Gwinnett Room, and I said, oh, my gosh, I know that name, and she remembered me from my first meeting. It was a small world, and I still have that paper. So, I mean, I still have my newcomer packet, and it's like just one of those sentimental things. I don't want to forget what my first meeting was like. And I said, I remember saying, you know, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And somebody came up to me after the meeting and he said, what makes you think you're not an alcoholic? And I said, well, I don't keep it in the house. You know, I only buy what I need for like that night or that day or whatever. And I only drink really on the weekends, but that wasn't true at that point. And I just had this whole list of things. And he said, in that meeting, they read more about alcoholism at every meeting. And he said, read page 31 in the big book. And he handed me a book that says The Gwinnett Room. And I still have that big book. And it was all the ways that alcoholics try to control their drinking. And I saw not having it in the house, only drinking on the weekends, and that list or, you know, something like that. And I remember getting this sinking feeling like, but I really struggled when I first came. I was, like I was saying before, terrified of people. I remember women being so nice to me and wanting to help me. And, you know, I just remember being like, I don't want to talk to you. Leave me alone. I was still doing the self, you know, I don't need people. I know I'm an alcoholic. I can do this on my own. I remember thinking that. So I was still coming to meetings and drinking and kind of had one foot in and one foot out. And I remember, I don't remember who it was, but I remember sitting on in the very back. This was at the Triangle Club, and I was, you know, in and out during the meeting, up and down to smoke and, you know, cutting up in the back. And I remember this old timer saying, oh, this is a half measure section. And I'll never forget that. I couldn't sit through a whole meeting. I mean, I was just up and down, up and down, up and down, you know, blah, 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 chattering and just, you know, making fun of whoever was talking. And, you know, I wasn't there. I remember people getting chips and thinking, there's no way that person has been sober for 18 years. Like, why, you know, why would you want to do that? And it's, I thought everybody was coming here and lying. Like, I thought for sure that it was just a big act, you know, like everyone's just wasting, you know, just kind of putting on a show for, and using, I remember telling somebody, yeah, I'm never going to use any of those buzzwords in AA. Like, that's what I called them, buzzwords. I thought that everybody was just saying it just to hear themselves talk. I mean, I just couldn't imagine that there was something other than what I knew. And so for a while, you know, I was just kind of one foot in, one foot out. But I had gotten to that point where all the fun was gone out of drinking. I was like, I did not want to drink anymore. But I didn't fully kind of buy into this and what people are saying, and I didn't quite believe people. And women would say to me, well, Lisa, do you believe that I believe? Do you believe that this is working for me? And I would just kind of be like, I guess. I mean, if you say so. And I was just so closed-minded still. And that it took a long time for that to be kind of chipped away. But so eventually it was, okay, I'm an alcoholic. I did not want to drink anymore, but I don't need to come to these meetings. So I think that lasted about 2 weeks. And I was still working at this dental office, this real prestigious dental office. And it was around the holidays. And they said, Lisa, we're opening a bottle of Cristal in the doctor's lounge. You want to have some? And I was like, oh, no, thanks. I don't drink anymore. And they said, yeah, right. So the next thing you know, I was back there, and I took a sip of it, and it was like this, I can't explain it, but just this feeling came over me like, oh, my God, I did it. I said I wasn't going to drink anymore. I did it again. And it was like I handed it to somebody as fast as I could and got out of there and just like, I just remember being so freaked out, like, this is what people are talking about. Like, that's when I started to understand what powerless meant, because I had said in my mind, I'm not doing this anymore. I can't. But I did it, and it was like some magnetic force was, like, you know, taking my hand, and I just couldn't stop. So I came back to AA, and this was, you know, end of December, and I just remember kind of being like, what do I have to do? And I went to the New Year's Eve, the young people in AA's New Year's Eve party. It was in Gwinnett, I think it was Norcross or something. This was the beginning of 07. And, you know, at that point I was still like, oh, I'm the youngest person here. And my younger brother is like, oh, we're going to the young people's thing, the New Year's Eve party tonight. And I was like, well, okay. So I went, and I remember being so just in awe of all the people there that were younger than me, and they were sober and happy. And they did a sobriety countdown where they had everybody stand in the middle, and they said, in a circle. They said, okay, if you have one day sober, you had to dance in the middle or something. They may have started with years or something, but, and then they had, you know, but I just remember looking around and thinking, gosh, there are people here younger than me that have been sober for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and they looked happy. I just remember looking around and being like, okay. And there was a girl there, her name was Emily, and she came up to me, and later she told me she came up to me because I looked freaked out, and she gave me the St. Francis prayer on a little card, and I still have that. It's been through the washing machine and everything, but I still carry it in my wallet, just, I don't know, to remember. I like to remember things like that, and so that was, I kind of see that as sort of the beginning of, I started to believe, okay, maybe these people know something that I don't. And Emily was, I remember her saying, well, do you have a sponsor yet? No. And I think this was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because she said, the 7:30 in the morning triangle meeting, she said, Lisa, she told me to start coming to that one. And I was like, okay, she'd been sober for a year. And she said, Lisa, this is your new sponsor. Her name is Julia. And I was like, okay. Well, this lady was diehard AA. I mean, she was like, she told me, you know, be there 7:30 in the morning every day. Come hell or high water, you need to be there. She had 5 years, and I was scared of her. I mean, I really was, because I tried smarting off to her, and she screamed at me. And I mean, I don't think that works for everybody. I don't, you know, I've heard talk to other alcoholics, but for me, that's what I needed, because, you know, I came in here, don't you know who I am, and that kind of thing. And this woman did not take anything from me. Like, she made me sit on the front row at Triangle, and if I wasn't there, I would hear about it. If I didn't sit in the front row, like front and center, and I said, why do I have to sit there? And she said, so I can keep an eye on you. And she sat in the same place every day. She didn't do anything. She didn't ask me to do anything or tell me to do anything that she wasn't already doing. I mean, she was always there every morning without fail. And so I started to take some suggestions from her. She was pregnant at the time, so it wasn't like a long-term thing. But, you know, looking back, that's what I needed. I needed to be there every day. I needed to have somebody kind of put me in my place, so that I could be available to listen, because that was my biggest problem, I think, was just not listening. I mean, I refused. So eventually, she and I kind of parted ways, and I met kind of a more gentle sponsor. She was younger than me, and she had been sober for a year and a half, and she took me through the steps. We met every Saturday, at Triangle, and we, you know, had the book and we did the steps. She spent a lot of time with me, and at first I remember thinking, you know, she's not going to be able to help me. She's from a really wealthy background. She's younger than me. You know, what does she know? But she helped me a lot. I mean, she kind of taught me, like, the basics. And I started, I remember her talking about God shots, because, you know, I was very closed-minded when it came to higher power and that kind of thing. And during that time when she and I were meeting every week, I did start to see these little coincidences that it's like, is it odd or is it God? And I remember a lady at the women's meeting, they used to meet, I don't know if it's still around, the stepsisters, but I remember her telling me, you need to write those down and call it your book of miracles. So I did that. I started writing those things down, and it's like, okay, is it odd or is it God? And one of those was I was at this work party at the dental office. I was still working at that dental office, and you know, it was the first time I had been around alcohol without I just hadn't been around alcohol up to this point. I think I was like 6 months sober, and they brought a champagne toast out. It was on an afternoon at Maggiano's, like an afternoon gathering or something. And I totally wasn't prepared for that. And I just remember seeing the waiter bring out glasses of champagne. And he was, you know, setting them out on the table. And nobody that I worked with knew what I was doing. They just kind of were like, oh, Lisa, did you get a makeover? I'm like, no, I got sober. But I remember when somebody said that to me, she like stopped in her tracks and she's like, Lisa, did you get a makeover? And I'm like, no. So they knew something was different, but they didn't know what. So I'm sitting there and they're passing out champagne. And I started sweating, like having a panic attack. What am I going to do when they get to me? I didn't want these people to know that I wasn't drinking or that I was an alcoholic or I was an AA. And I was thinking, well, I'll just pick up the glass and pretend to drink it, or I'll just go to the bathroom when they do the toast, or, you know, I was coming up with all these crazy ideas. And, I mean, I was really working myself up into a frenzy. And I turn around, and the waiter had skipped me. He gave a glass of champagne to everybody but me. And people say, oh, did he know you were an alcoholic? And no, I look at it like, I think that was just, you know, one of those coincidences, like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I just picked up the water glass, and they were like, oh, Lisa didn't get any champagne. And I'm like, that's okay, I'll just toast with the water. And I remember leaving there thinking that it was like a, you know, a higher power saying, Lisa, you know, if you do, you know, what these people ask, then you don't have to worry about drinking. And it's been that way since, as long as I am staying close to the program and the people in it. I've had ups and downs, periods of being really, really, you know, into the program, doing, you know, what I need to do for my spiritual condition and to stay connected to other people. And then times where, you know, maybe I'm doing a little less. But I've found that during those periods of less, my higher power kind of always gives me a little nudge. Sometimes it's a big one. Sometimes it's a really little one. Like the little one is, you know, there's a treatment center down in Henry County, and we take meetings there. And I remember, this was pretty recently, there's a girl sitting across from me that was in treatment. We brought the meeting in there, and it was like I was sitting across from myself. I mean, she looked like me. She acted like I did when I came in. She said some of the same things when she shared. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like, it was, I mean, it was, and she started calling me when she got out, and, you know, I worked with her for a little while. She's back in treatment now. But it was, you know, that little reminder that I needed from my higher power that, you know, that's what I have to look forward to if I don't do what I'm supposed to do in the program. And a couple of years ago, actually 3 years ago tonight, there's people in this room that were when this happened, but myself, Will Run Riot, took over, and I broke my leg in an ice skating accident. I had no business being there in the first place, but I had to have emergency surgery, have a plate and 7 pins in my leg, and this is all because of my self-will. And before this had happened, you know, it was Lisa taking her will back. People were like, Lisa, maybe you shouldn't go. And I'm like, no, I'm going to go. And, you know, it was like one of those things I just had kind of taken over again. Well, I wound up on crutches and had to use a walker, and I couldn't drive or go anywhere for 3 months. And it was my higher power showing me how to ask for help again, because I had gotten to a point where I remember sitting over here and sharing about it the week before this happened, that, you know, I had just gotten a speeding ticket on the way to the meeting. And I was like, oh, I'm just really complacent, and I don't, you know, just self-pity, and life wasn't going the way I wanted, and, you know, I kind of lost touch with my sponsor a little bit, and just kind of wasn't doing the things that I had done. I had 3 years sober, and the next week, I had to ask for help again, and it was in a big way. I had to ask for help. I mean, I couldn't, you know, that first week or two, I could barely get out of bed. I mean, just, I remember waking up and someone in this room, a lady in this room, I remember her calling me. She visited me in the hospital, and she was there by my side the whole time. And I remember, I'm sorry, I remember her saying, you know, I texted her and I said, I'm in hell, when I was in the hospital, and she said, I'll be there to walk beside you the whole way, and she was. But it was like asking, I had to reach out to other women and people in this program and ask for help again, and that was like, It was a huge lesson. You know, when Lisa's will takes over, it's never a good thing. Because, I mean, I got my ass handed to me. Thank you. And the good side of that is that, you know, I met people that I never would have met. There's someone in this room that used to pick me up from work when I couldn't drive. And he would take me to a meeting. And this, I'm sorry, this is, I mean, it happened 3 years ago tonight that I broke my leg, so I was thinking on the way over here, like, I don't know if that's a coincidence or what. I was like, okay, here I am talking about recovery. But, you know, it was a lesson. And I had to get back to in the program. I mean, I remember waking up, just, I slept with my big book in the bed next to me, and it was like every morning I had to wake up and read 4:17, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. Because I remember those first couple of weeks after it happened, I could not accept it. I could not. And I remember my sponsor at the time saying, you don't have a choice. Like, your leg is broken in 4 places. You know, it was a big lesson in acceptance, and a big lesson in asking for help and picking up the phone again. And, you know, not taking my will back. And so at that point, I wasn't saying the third step prayer every day, and now I do. I say it every morning, and I thank God every night for my sobriety, and I get down on my knees, and
I didn't do that before. So, I mean, as bad as that was, you know, I learned a lot from it, and I learned a lot from, you know, people in this program, men and women. I mean, there's some old timers that, you know, there's one in this room that I just remember talking to this person, like, I mean, he was always there when some of my darkest days, and you know, there was a woman that I met at a women's meeting here, and I'd never seen her before, and she was a little bit older than me, but she had 17 years, and I just remember being in awe of her, like, wow, 17 years, and she would pick me up and take me to meetings, and, you know, she would talk to me. I would call her and, you know, go on and on with my self-pity, and she'd be like, well, where'd you sleep last night? Did you sleep in a bed? Yeah. Okay, well, you need to be thankful for that. You know, she kind of taught me again. I had to relearn gratitude again because I have a built-in forgetter. But she came into my life for, you know, that brief time, and she's since faded away. But I think my higher power does that too, just puts people in my life for a reason. And I, you know, she helped me, and I'm sure working with me helped her to an extent. But anyway, so my leg is better now, and I did get to go to graduate school. You know, I tried to make something happen when I was drinking with being a dentist. Well, it turns out that doesn't really fit who I am. My personality is in a lab doing research. I never thought that that was me, but since I've been around working the program and, you know, staying close to the program, it just kind of fell into place where I didn't have to fight. I didn't have to spend a lot of money trying to make something happen. It just fell into place, and it's exactly where I'm supposed to be. I mean, I was born to do what I'm doing. It's like a, I just get really excited about it, and I haven't had to force it, and it makes me think of the page 100 in the big book says something like, you know, when we place ourselves in God's hands, things can be better than we've ever imagined, or something along those lines. And I've found that to be true. When I stopped fighting, stopped trying to make something happen, this school thing that I've always wanted has just fallen into place. I graduated with a master's 2 weeks ago, and I'm starting a PhD on January 7th. And it's just me. I mean, it fits me. It's I've had to work through some relationships there, and with the help of my sponsor in Stockbridge. But it's all just falling into place, and I know my life is much more smooth, and there's many more happy endings when I am not isolated, you know, when I stick to, when I let people know what's going on with me, and when I don't take my will back. For me, the third step prayer is huge. And so I just moved to Athens to start my PhD. Not last night, but the night before. So the promises are coming true. I know that it's like the layers of an onion. More will be revealed, but AA is the best thing that's ever happened to me, and I'm really glad to be here and glad to be sober. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa. Powerful story. And we got to see it happen, some of it anyway.
First I slip, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that sets me free. Where the promises are.